afternoon, Guelph, and welcome to another episode, edition of Open Sources Guelph. My name is Scotty Hertz, and sadly today, I am alone in the studio. I'm not alone in the station, but I'm alone in the studio. Adam is on assignment this week, and we'll hear all about that next week, I'm fairly sure. It's absolutely nothing to do with politics, at least I don't think so, but we'll let him talk about that next week. So we've got some special programming for you today because, I mean, I could sit here and talk for an hour. I really could, but it's you know, it's just not possible. I need my partner. Absolutely. So I'm going to defer, and we're going to go back in time a bit and play some classic things. If you may have seen it on our website, opensourcesguelph.com, that we're going retro today. I'm going to play some of the classic Canadian speeches, moments. I was going to say of the past, I don't know, 40, 50 years, the majority of which come from the 60s and early 70s, because that's when sound quality began to get good, I guess. I'm going to start off with Tommy Douglas, moving on to John F. Diefenbaker, a bit from Lester Pearson when he stepped down as leader of the Liberals in 1968, and then there's the second, I'll get to the second half when we get to the second half. So anyway, let's start off with Tommy Douglas. In 1971, Tommy Douglas stepped down as leader of the NDP, and leadership was taken over by David Lewis. And I know on our website, I believe it said it was going to play the Mouseland speech from 1944, which is a classic NDP thing. They refer to it a lot. It's a very good speech, actually, if you're so inclined. And even if you're not that way politically inclined, it's a good one for sure. Elect more mice, I think, was the summation of that. But anyway, this is Tommy Douglas in 1971 talking about his life in politics in general and stepping down as NDP leader and the future. So let's get to that now.
New Democrats, mes chers amis, all my life, I've wished that it were possible that I could attend my own funeral and listen to the eulogies that would be made on my behalf. But I knew that this would be extremely difficult since I'd have to be dead. Laurie LaPierre and his committee have made it possible for me to listen to the eulogies without the disadvantage of having passed on to another world. But never in my wildest dreams did I expect to have eulogies delivered by such talented and eloquent spokesmen. And I would like to thank Pierre Burton, this noted author and outstanding radio personality. And to say that I know of no one in Canada from whom I would appreciate this tribute more than from this man. I want to assure you that my wife, Irma, and myself are deeply touched by these tributes, that we are profoundly grateful for this occasion. I am glad that you included Irma, because as someone has said, behind every successful man, there's a surprised mother-in-law. I have been fortunate that in all my political career, I've had someone who has helped me and encouraged me. And tonight, I'm glad that you are paying tribute to her. I want to say to Grant Notley, that I am not saying goodbye either. I propose to stay in the House of Commons until the next election. Our supporters in Nanaimo, Couch, and the Islands have done me the great honor of nominating me to contest the next federal election. And if God gives me strength and the electorate give me votes, I'll be here fighting at the same old stand for the things in which you and I believe. But tonight, my wife Irma and I did not come here so much to receive your thanks, although we are deeply grateful for it. We have come tonight to thank you, to thank the hundreds of thousands of people you represent who have made anything we have done possible. I think of the men and women who 35 years ago and more dreamed the impossible dream. Men and women who lived beyond the lean horizon of their years, who believed devoutly that it was possible to have a more humane and a more just society, and who gave of their time and their money and their energy to begin building it. The men and women who traveled in all kinds of weather and in all kinds of vehicles, who went from schoolhouse to schoolhouse, organizing, raising money, who canvassed from door to door, who passed out literature, who manned the polls, who drove cars on election day. You who are here and thousands whom you represent, these are the men and women to whom we should be profoundly grateful. And I feel tonight a great flow of gratitude to them. And I am filled with wonder that I, raised in a working-class home on the wrong side of the tracks in the city of Winnipeg, should have been given the opportunity by the working people of this country to make a contribution to the public life of Canada, which I hope will long endure. If I were asked to sum up for the people of Canada and for the New Democratic Party what I have learned from more than a third of a century in public life, I would sum it up by saying to them that it is possible in this country of ours to build a society in which there will be full employment, in which there will be a higher standard of living, in which there will be an improved quality of life, while at the same time maintaining a reasonable stability in the cost of living. We don't have to have 750,000 unemployed. We don't have to choose between unemployment and inflation. My message to you is that we don't have to do this. My message to you is that we have in Canada the resources, the technical know-how, and the industrious people who could make this a great land if we were prepared to bring these various factors together in building a planned economy dedicated to to meeting human needs and responding to human wants.
A free Canadian, free to speak without fear, free to worship God in my own way, free to stand for what I think right, free to oppose what I believe wrong, free to choose those who shall govern my country. This heritage of freedom I pledge to uphold for myself and all mankind, for I am a Canadian. On December the 17th, 1941, a badly damaged Spitfire aircraft of the Royal Canadian Air Force staggered to a landing on an airfield outside London, its pilot dead. That pilot was John Gillespie McGee, a boy of 19 years of age, a man for all generations. In his tunic was a sonnet he had written on the back of a letter to his mother, words that live today and always will. I would like to read those words to you now. Slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter's silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed and joined the tumbling mirth of sun-split clouds and done 100 things you have not dreamed of. Wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence. Hovering there, I've chased the shouting wind along and flung my eager craft through footless halls of air. Up, up, the long, delirious, burning blue, I've topped the heights with easy grace, where never lark or even eagle flew. And while with silent, lifting mind I've trod the high, untrespassed sanctity of space, put out my hand and touched the face of God. There must be a realization by all of us that we're Canadians, that we disagree. If we all thought alike, nobody would be thinking. The man who sits opposite is just as conscientiously in favor of his country and the betterment of that country than the one who sits with you as a colleague. I'll give you an example. It has to do with British politics. In 1961, the Right Honorable Harold Macmillan, the Prime Minister, had my wife and me to dinner. She sat to his right, and on the other side of her was the indomitable and the incomparable Sir Winston Churchill. I was on the other side of the table, far down. I was introduced to a Mrs. Chamberlain. I said to her, seeing Sir Winston in the happiest of good humor, engaged in the warmest of conversations with my wife and Mr. Macmillan, I said, it's wonderful to see the old man so happy. Yes, she said. It's wonderful that he's here, too. for you and I would not be here but for him. The speaker was Mrs. Neville Chamberlain, who died very recently, and was speaking of the man who had driven her husband out of public life. That's my idea of parliamentary government. The first time I met Winston Churchill was in 1941 in December. I had seen him in the gallery, from the gallery of the House of Commons in 1916 when he was in disgrace following Gallipoli. When he got up to speak with the mud of France on his uniform, the house emptied. I saw him in 1932 when he was a pariah. I saw him in 1936 when he became the king's man at the time of the abdication. I saw him in 1939. I said to him, "Prime Minister, the first time I saw you, you were in disgrace." His answer, "Which time was that?" I happened to be a teetotaler, and the first occasion that my wife and I were at lunch at Churchill's was in 1957. All during the luncheon, he was reaching down. I wonder what he was reaching for. Finally, he came up with a bottle, which even to my unpracticed eye represented one of the few remaining portions of Napoleonic brandy. It was about half full, the bottle. He said, "Will you have some?" And I said, "I never take any." And he put his earpiece on so that he could hear me more clearly. I said, "I'm a teetotaler." And he said, "You're a what? Are you a prohibitionist?" And I said, "No. It was a prohibitionist who beat you in Dundee in 1920. And he said, "Yes, I had very bad luck that year. I had two or three defeats in succession." And he said, "So you're not Lake Scrimgeour, who was the successful candidate against him on that occasion?" I said, "No, I'm a teetotaler, but not a prohibitionist." He found difficulty in understanding that. His wife helped out. Finally, he got it clear. He said, "What you say is this, that you are a teetotaler and not a prohibitionist." I said, "That's right." "Oh, in that case, you only hurt yourself."
Churchill was terrible when the time. I was there the day that in 51, when the conservative member left and went over to the Labour side because they didn't expect the old man would win again, you see. Well, Churchill watched him. Finally, the member came to rest in the far back seat. Well, Churchill said, "Mr. Speaker, this is the first time in recorded history that anyone has ever seen a rat swimming towards a sinking ship."
You have been here for many hours. It's been a trying day and an exciting day for all of us. And I think it's a little bit late for those who wanted to see the hockey playoffs. So could I tell them that there will probably be some action tonight at the Skyline Hotel and that we should all be there. Thank you very much. Yes, it is true.
Pierre Elliott Trudeau. His moment of glory. Then already the shadow of responsibility. Those grave decisions that the Prime Minister must make alone. There's a cabinet to remake. Here now is Prime Minister Pearson.
My friends, I want to go to the hockey game too. But I do want to say a word before this wonderful convention breaks up. Our new leader speaks such beautiful French, I think I'll speak in English tonight. I'm going to do something which is not usual. I'm going to begin by congratulating the losers in this contest for the fight that they put up. Perhaps I may be pardoned if I single out one who was fighting the battles of liberalism and security and freedom in Parliament before some who are here as delegates today were born. Paul Martin. Who battled in this campaign from the beginning and who withdrew with gallantry and chivalry. As to our new leader, soon to be our new Prime Minister, I was a little worried about one thing he said when he talked about making my wife his official hostess. Well, if he takes her over, I'll still have my dog. I ask for all of us, to rally around him as a united party. And I pledge my own support, everything I can do, to help him in his new responsibilities. I ask for him the loyalty and the help in good times and in hard times, and he will have both, that you have given me, and without which no leader, no matter what miraculous qualities he may have or have been given, without which no leader can carry successfully the awesome burdens of office. It is especially true that when the weather is stormy and the going is tough, that he is going to need our backing and our encouragement. And we must give it to him. I know we will. And he will be facing very serious problems at once. He'll have little time for rest and reflection. Because in a few days, he'll be thrown into the arena, and there are some self-styled lions there waiting to devour another Christian. But having disposed of them, I know he will lead a government that will do great things for Canada, our beloved country. Give it off, Moncef.
I would offer to you, my leader, my very sincere congratulations and my support. I know that you will enjoy success because I know that you deserve it.
Before I stop, might be to congratulate once again that now that this great convention is coming to an end, all those who have been responsible for its organization and its management and the conduct of business, because it's been a wonderful conference. They have worked around the clock They have worked effectively, and they have worked well, and we owe them a great deal. This conference, this convention, has been a very great success. It's a fine augury for our party to go forward. It's been a great success, and if it has, it has been due to the members of the party who have offered themselves as leaders of the party, and it above all has been due to you as delegates. I wish you all well, and I wish for my successor everything that is good, success, satisfaction, and the reward that comes from work well done. Thank you.
Canada, Lester B. Pearson, a.k.a. Mike Pearson, retiring in 1968, handing the reins over to the newly elected Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who was the new kid in town. Although he was a little bit older than his son was when he took over. I think Trudeau was about 50 when he got the gig. And yeah, nowadays when a leader retires, there's PowerPoint presentations and movies and accolades and... you get like a whole day at a convention. Mike Pearson got about 5 minutes, and I guess everybody went and watched the hockey game they were talking about. Don't know which hockey game. Then, of course, that convention and the election of Trudeau led into the 1968 election, which is going to be coming up after the break. I'm going to play a little bit of the 1968 debate between Trudeau and Robert Stanfield from the Conservatives and Tommy Douglas once again from the NDP. And I'm going to skip about, I don't know, just over an hour in. We're not going to get that far. Réal Couette from the Social Credit Party, which was still a force back in those days. I think they had 20-odd seats, makes an appearance, and he spoke exclusively in French. Debates were a little bit different back then. I'm going to skip Couette mostly because, well, not just because it's in French, but he was also a fan of... Hitler and Mussolini. So, we'll take a pass on that. I don't think he mentioned it in the debate, but we won't get to that part. If you're really, really a diehard Politico like we are, you can check it out. It's on YouTube, the 1968 Canadian federal election debate. I'm going to play a sample of it. And if you like that sample enough, you can watch the whole 2 hours like I did. What a nerd, eh? There you go. So anyway, that's coming up in part two. Before that, we heard... a bit from John Diefenbaker's album. I think it came out in the 70s. I Am a Canadian, or Because I Am a Canadian. And it was him reminiscing about his life with sound effects, which is really strange. It was a thing for a while there that when somebody left, I mean, obviously you wrote your memoirs, but they also put out an album. I remember seeing one for Flora McDonald, who was a long-running MP. I should have bought it. It was like 50 cents, right? But I didn't. Anyway, that was a thing back in the 70s. So they're readily available. You go to any sort of used record place and you'll find albums like that lying around. Lots of Kennedy ones. I think it may have started with Kennedy, anything Kennedy, and went from there. And of course, before that, we heard Tommy Douglas stepping down. He was still an MP after that, but he stepped down in 1971 from the leadership of the NDP. And man, talk about oration. Things are different now, I think, in terms of the way people speak. I think... the old timers were able to think on the feet a bit more, for sure. I mean, even though, you know, speeches are speeches, but they were able to, I don't know, things were different then, obviously. And also, yeah, a lot different. I'm going to skip the part in the coming up when Tommy Douglas calls homosexuality a disease. That came up in the debate in 1968. That's also readily available on YouTube as well if you watch the whole thing. Things were different then. Things are different now. Anyway, so I hope you're enjoying this flashback episode of Open Sources. My name is Scotty Hertz, and we're here every Thursday from 5 to 6, and it seems we're on the repeat lots of times. I think we're Monday morning at 6 and other times. So you're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM. We'll be back in a few minutes after some messages and a little bit of music.
There is power in a union.
sure you're all aware, it's Labor Day weekend, and that one's for the workers. That was Billy Bragg, I think the album's from 1984, talking with the tax man about poetry, and that was There's Power in a Union. And if you're interested, I'll be playing the Labor Day Picnic. Talk about self-plug. Labor Day Picnic on Monday runs, I believe it's from 12 to 3. I think I'm on at 12:15. I might just have a crack at that song, but I won't be singing it like this, right? I'll just do my thing. Anyway, so that's Monday. Hot dogs, things to buck, the rides are free. It's a good time. So if you want any more information on that, I don't know, check online. Anyway, the 1968 Canadian federal debate was the first debate televised ever in Canada. And it was interesting in lots of ways. Debates are always interesting for political types, but this one in particular, not just because it was the first, but some of the topics they discuss and whatever. Let's let them get to it, and I will be quiet now. But anyway, this is an excerpt, the first chunk of the 1968 Canadian federal debate, which was covered on CBC and CTV, and I've cut it off, but the announcer, I believe, was Lloyd Robertson, so with his biggest, boomingest voice on. But anyway, let's get to that now.
Charles?
Well, now for the opening statements, and first, Mr. Trudeau.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Je suis très heureux d'être ici ce soir.
I'm very happy to be with
Durant
you here this evening.
Electorale,
throughout this election campaign, I have been saying that I believed in dialogue and debate. I do believe that the government of a democratic country must be essentially based on intelligence and reasoning. I believe that in an election campaign, we have been trying to exchange ideas with the people. We feel that a good government can exist only if it is supported by the people.
Some say that there might have been some risks for a prime minister to accept this type of debate. I rather think that the risk would exist if we didn't accept debate, because a democracy is essentially an exchange of ideas between those who govern and those who are governed, and a good government can only exist if there is this kind of exchange of ideas, this kind of confrontation between those who aspire to lead the people. I believe in this Canada. I believe in this very exciting and growing country of ours. I know there are problems. I know these problems affect especially the poor, those who don't have enough houses, the old people who can't make ends meet, those who don't find enough jobs. This is why we have governments and a democracy, in order that the people be able to express these problems, in order that those who govern them be able to discuss the solutions. And it's in this sense that we can have a good government, if we share not only the problems, but the hopes for the future. And this is what we want to do in this election, and this is what we hope we will be doing in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Stanfield. Your opening statement, please.
At the outset, I would like to mention briefly Senator Robert Kennedy, whom the world mourns. Il vit très bien les conflits qui affligent.
He knew the conflicts which afflicted American society, and he made an appeal to the conscience of his country and not its prejudices. He was a rich man, but a man who was really concerned with the poor and the oppressed. He always tried to bring out what was good in America, not what was less good. He was not satisfied with simple slogans. He searched solutions for the problems of his country. And in the spirit of this tragic loss, conscious of our own society here, we must recognize that our prime responsibility is to Canadian democracy, that we owe it.
I hope the parties and party leaders would work to bring the Canadian people together and not to push them apart. This has been my intention, as it is now, and will continue to be. But we are faced by serious problems in Canada, and it's my purpose tonight not to exchange platitudes, but to discuss the issues. We have a housing crisis in our country, and we have presented specific policies to meet this crisis, to help the ordinary Canadian acquire a home, to ease the load somewhat on the tenant caught by escalating rentals, and to create more jobs through more housing starts. And I'm prepared tonight to discuss these policies. We must do something also about the condition of the hundreds of thousands of Canadians who are poor and growing poorer. And another generation of Canadians is being trapped in poverty, and we propose to reform our inefficient and wasteful welfare system with a view to increasing initiative, improving skills, and helping those who are either caught by public welfare or personal poverty to regain a sense of personal dignity and accomplishment. And we're prepared tonight, I'm prepared tonight to discuss these policies. The Prime Minister and his Minister of Finance say that our economy has never been stronger, but Canadian wage earners, Canadian pensioners, and Canadian consumers can't agree with this because they know that we have a serious problem of unemployment as well as record inflation with record rates of interest. And while our government visits the financial capitals of the world to borrow money to meet their expenditures. One of the first duties of a new government must be to restore confidence inside and outside Canada, and I'm prepared to discuss these policies. And we have proposed specific policies relating to agriculture, and I'm prepared to discuss these and other policies tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Stanfield. Now, Mr. Douglas, your opening statement, please.
These are troubled times in which we live. The world around us is racked with dissension and violence. Here in Canada, so far, we have escaped these dangers. But all of us are concerned about our country and its future. We're disturbed because of the danger of disintegration from within and the threat of absorption from without. We are disturbed because Canadians in some regions have less social and economic opportunities than those in others. We're disturbed because our economy is not expanding fast enough to find jobs for all our people, and because some 500,000 Canadians live below the poverty line. We're disturbed because rising living costs and inadequate housing is bringing frustration and resentment into our lives. We're disturbed because thousands of our farmers and fishermen are caught in an economic squeeze. But things don't have to be this way. The answer lies in a strong federal government capable of initiating programs to cope effectively with these problems. I believe that this can be done without violating the traditional linguistic and cultural rights of the French-speaking community. I believe that we can marshal the human, material, and financial resources of this country to eradicate poverty, inequality, and insecurity. But to do this, we must be prepared to revise our scale of values. Cooperation must take precedence over competition. People before profits. Planning before drifting. I believe in this country, its people, and its future. With our vast resources, with our technical know-how, we can make this a land where every child will have enough to eat, where every young person capable of absorbing an education will be able to get one, where every person who wants to work can find a job, and where every family that wants a home will be able to own one. A land where our old people can live out their days in dignity and security, and where our young people can live useful and meaningful lives. As Canadians, you and I can strive for nothing better, and surely we should settle for nothing less.
Thank you, Mr. Douglas. Well, now, incidentally, these earpieces, which you'll be seeing through the debate, are for the translation. And if there are any brief pauses as we go along, it's because we're waiting for the finish of the translation. Well, now for the debate. And, gentlemen, I hope you'll have at each other. The questions will be put by our panel of broadcast journalists. And they are Jean-Marc Poliquin of Radio-Canada, Tom Gould, CTV, and Ron Collister of the CBC. Ron?
Mr. Trudeau, if this debate had been held last week, this question probably wouldn't have been asked. But this week we've been made aware in the ugliest possible way that this is the violent society we live in. In view of the increasing violence in North America, are you prepared to require the fingerprinting and stringent licensing of all owners of all firearms?
Of all owners of?
Of all firearms.
I don't think that this would effectively prevent the illegal use of firearms. People who use firearms in an illegal way are very hard to control. We have introduced amendments to the criminal code, which we hope will permit to at least control those firearms, which are the dangerous ones, those which can be concealed, handguns, sawed-off shotguns, and other dangerous forms of automatic weapons. We want to restrict the use, the purchasing, the selling of these arms. It will be a difficult enough job to ensure the registration of all such arms, to ensure their control. I think it wouldn't be practical to want to demand legally the fingerprinting of all users of all arms, which would include hunting guns and many other types of sporting weapons. Therefore, I think we mustn't try to go too far lest we have legislation which cannot be effective. We must try to have good, effective legislation, and that type of arm which can easily be concealed and which is generally the kind of arm that illegal people want to use.
Mr. Stanfield?
I don't believe that we should resort to fingerprinting necessarily, because I don't think it's possible to prevent all assassinations of this sort. For example, I was sitting behind the Prime Minister this afternoon in church and could quite easily have done him in, and nobody could possibly have stopped me if I'd suddenly gone off my rocker. I'm interested in doing him in some other way, but not that way. But it may be that we should consider going further than we have in connection with weapons. Not merely those that are possibly concealed, but taking some measures to see that the permits are not held by psychotics or by people of this sort. I don't wish to interfere unduly with the freedom of our people, our hunters, and people who are members of gun clubs and this sort of thing, who pursue legitimate activities. But I do believe that we should consider at least ensuring, as far as we can, that dangerous people, people who are dangerous because of their mental condition, for example, don't have permits to hold guns. And I don't minimize the difficulties in supervising or enforcing such a provision.
Mr. Douglas, please.
It seems to me that the legislation which was before the House, and which unfortunately was never proceeded with, is a good first step. I think we ought to require the registration of all small arms. I think we should make it a criminal offense for any person to carry weapons unless he has a special dispensation from the police and is in some danger. And I think it's a great pity that Canada has been so slow in introducing such legislation, and it's even more regrettable that the House dissolved without dealing with that legislation and some of the other legislation which was on the order paper. But the danger is not just in weapons. The danger is in the kind of people who can get hold of weapons. I think that governments in Canada have been singularly neglectful about the whole problem of mental illness. The case of Lee Harvey Oswald, who is allegedly the person who assassinated President Kennedy. The story of his life is interesting, that when he was 14 years of age, he was proven to be a psychotic who should have been brought to treatment. Nothing was done. And here in Canada, we have left mental illness out of our hospital insurance plan. We've left mental illness out of our Medicare plan. And unless we have some consistent program for locating people who are psychotics and treating them, we will have many other cases of violence.
A question now for Mr. Stanfield from Tom Gould.
Mr. Stanfield, a number of opinion polls in recent months have indicated growing public concern over the tax burden imposed by all levels of government in Canada. Some economists say the tax load is reaching the outer limits of toleration. Will you now, and I address this question equally to Mr. Trudeau and Mr. Douglas, will you now give the Canadian taxpayers a commitment not to raise federal taxes above their present general level if you form a government after June 25th?
I think that Canadian taxes have reached their limit, and I agree that the share of the gross national product taken by taxes should not be allowed to increase. We are committed in my party to remove the 11% sales tax on building materials, although we recognize that this may have to be replaced in whole or in part from a tax of some other source. It's our belief that through cooperation with the provinces, through working out priorities with the provinces to ensure that the limited resources that are available go to the most important purposes, this is the most important step to be taken in connection with maintaining the tax level as it is. I agree that the present tax level is inflationary, and that increases in taxes at this level are inflationary. So you have the two reasons, at least, for ensuring that the tax level is not allowed to take a bigger slice of the gross national product. It's the effect on the individual Canadian taxpayer who's bearing such a load now, and the inflationary pressures that increases in taxes produce at this level. So I would state firmly that as far as the federal government is concerned, I would not allow our share of the gross national product, our share of taxation, take a bigger share of the gross national product, and we work closely with the provinces to cooperation to see, as best I could, this was true of taxation over the whole country.
Mr. Douglas.
Well, even more important than deciding whether taxes should go up is whether or not the tax burden is equitably distributed. This is the problem that we should be facing up to. The Carter Report, which came from a commission appointed by the Conservatives, and the report which commission was made to the present government, has been ignored by both the parties. And I think we ought tonight to know where both the government and the official opposition stand with reference to this report. Here's a report which says, first, that the burden of taxation falls too heavily on the middle and lower income groups, which says, secondly, that the freeloaders, the oil companies, the insurance companies, the mining companies, the stock speculators and land speculators, are getting a free ride, that some $5,000 million of income a year is virtually untaxed, and that if these people paid the same taxes as other businessmen and other personal income taxpayers, that we would increase government revenue by over $600 million, even on the basis of 1964, and that we could reduce the personal income tax for practically all Canadian citizens with incomes under $10,000. Seems to me, before we talk about raising taxes or lowering taxes, the first thing to do is to have an equitable and fair and just tax system. And I say to Mr. Trudeau that he can't talk about a just society until he, first of all, is prepared to commit himself to establishing a just tax structure in this country.
Mr. Trudeau.
Well, I think it might be well to remind ourselves that the federal taxes between 1962 and 1968 did not go up. They went down. If you take the average person, if you take the income earner of about $5,000 with two dependents, his tax was in the area of It was in the area of 280. It's now 220. The difference is, of course, that the total taxes, which include provincial and municipal tax, that did go up considerably. If you look, once again, over a period of 10 years, total federal taxes only went up by something like 56%, whereas total provincial and municipal taxes went up by something like 206%. Therefore, it's obvious in our country that the federal proportion of taxes is rising very slowly, not at all as fast as it is in the provinces, including your own province, Mr. Stanfield, where you come from. It's a question for the Canadian government to balance their expenditures with their revenues over the long haul. I wouldn't promise that taxes wouldn't go up. I would promise that we will limit our expenditures so that we don't have to raise our taxes any more than we have to.
Question now for Mr. Douglas.
And there you have it, the first part of the 1968 federal election debate. What's that saying in French again about plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose, I think it is. It's amazing how much changes and yet how much stays the same. I would say one of the key changes is there's far more women involved in politics now than we saw in any of that stuff back in the 60s and prior. Not even on the radar from what I can tell. And I should mention the reason why that gun question came up was because a few days before the debate, Robert Kennedy had been assassinated in June of 1968. So I think the media there were just asking questions. It doesn't look like there was any prep at all. I mean, I suppose there's always preparation with these things, but things like televised debates were new. I mean, we expect them now, but back in those days, it was pretty fresh. It was medium as the message kind of days where it's, oh, you know, we should do this. They're doing it in America. We should do, I think the first one in the States was Kennedy versus Nixon, 1960. So, and now it's just standard practice that we have these debates. So interesting to hear. And it's also interesting how Justin says Canada, just like his father. It's interesting to watch. He's very much a chip off the old block. And so is Alexander Trudeau, who is coming, it seems. There's a poster in the studio here. Saturday, September 17th, 2016 at 1 p.m. Alexander Trudeau, the oldest of the Trudeau sons, will be coming to town talking about his book, Barbarian Lost, Travels in the New China. War Mem, general admission, $10, $5, students with your ID. And the students are coming back fast and furious this weekend. They're already in town. Tickets are available at the bookshelf or online at emwftix.ca. And I'm sure that will probably be a full house. If it isn't, I'll be surprised. So first, I guess it's Edenmills Writers Festival is bringing him to town. And that's also on, I don't see the deets on our poster board, but it's coming. So Google that as well, Edenmills Writers Festival. You've been listening to Open Sources here on CFRU 93.3 FM. My name is Scotty Hertz. We are here every Thursday, even when there's only one of us or none of us, from 5 to 6 p.m. And if you want to reach us, I'm not going to go through the list of, I'll give you mine. Scotty Hertz on Twitter, Scotty Hertz on Facebook. I blog at a place called The Spanner Book, spannerbook.wordpress.com. And if you want to find anything else about us, you want to get in touch with us and all that, just Google Open Sources Guelph and you'll find us. We have a Facebook page. We have blogs. We have all kinds of stuff. And Guelph Politico, Adam A. Donaldson, all over the internet, all over the everywhere. So you should be able to find us, no problem. Anyway, we will be back next week with a more standard show, I believe. And I'm hoping to get a full report from Adam as to just what the heck he was up to this week. Very mysterious assignment, but we'll let him talk about that next week. Anyway, folks, thanks for joining me, and we'll see you next week. We'll be right back.